Welcome to That One Record. I'm Kyle Cresce, and this is episode 9. Today, we sit down with singer and guitar player Kenny Bridges of the band Monin to discuss their 2006 album, The Red Tree. Monin is a super special band for me personally. I grew up only about an hour away from them. I was seeing them all the time play local shows around the area, small clubs, and just watching sort of the trajectory of this band really take off. And it was one that really connected with me because they are one of the best live acts you will ever see. Just an insane amount of energy, incredibly tight. The songs are great. They connected with such a wide audience, specifically around this area in those very early days. And as they got bigger and bigger, they signed to Vagrant. They kind of hit this great peak with the Red Tree. And we talk in the interview about how they were kind of a little bit of the underdog band. You know, they were the only Canadian band on Vagrant. Even in Canada here, they were still playing clubs. You know, they felt like still part of the punk scene here. The Canadian music scene is very insular. It's very tight. They were kind of on the edges of it at times, which almost made you cheer for them more because you knew what they were doing. They were working so hard. Like, we talk about it in this episode, just how insane their tour schedule was at the time. They never stopped. They were putting out great records. They were just doing everything you wanted to see from a band that came from a scene that felt like it was yours. Kenny just gives us so much great insight on this record from the recording process, which me personally, if you might not recognize the name Brian McTernan by chance, the guy who recorded this album, but I can guarantee if you look up his credits, he has done at least one record you hold dear. I can pretty much guarantee it. So I was super interested in hearing about the process, and it fully delivered. Some of the stories, just how they work creatively, sounded like such a blast, and it was such great insight. We talk about that. We talk about the release of the record, album art, touring, favorite moments. We kind of get into it all here. We definitely touch on, are we really happy, you know, the record right before this. And we even kick off with the Switcheroo Split EP with a band, another Canadian band called Alexis on Fire, that was a real big one around these parts, and I think was kind of the jump off point for what became the Red Tree. And that's where we're going to start. Kenny's going to kind of take us behind what I thought was just an absolutely insane story about how little forethought and planning was put into the Switcheroo Split versus how big of a record that ended up being for a lot of people. So this one's a bit longer than normal, but I'm dropping it on a holiday. Cry about it. You got nothing else to do. So stick around. Trust me. It delivers.
So this is Kyle's podcast, take one. Action.
Perfect. So we're going to talk about 2006's The Red Tree. So third LP in the bunch. You're coming off Are We Really Happy? I want to kind of start it around the Switcheroo era.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
2005, you release the Switcheroo EP. I guess, did Vagrant technically title it just the Alexis on Fire Monin Split? Was the Switcheroo a Dynalone thing?
Well, yes. Switcheroo was mainly like it was birthed in the Dynalone world. I think Vagrant, because that was pre Alexis signing to Vagrant, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay, so they maybe hadn't they agreed were talking to do Crisis yet.
No, I don't know. But you know what? To be honest, like that timeline, because see, 2003, Really Happy came out, and we toured. I don't have the actual list. I think Peter, as our drummer, has like a list of all the shows we actually played. But I think we played just over 300 shows in 2003. So that was like a real busy, insane time for us. We were touring with pretty much anyone from the punk rock scene, emo scene that you can think of that you would want to tour with. We somehow ended up on tour with them. So it was a real whirlwind. So by the time we were doing Switcheroo, we were kind of in like a, we were burnt out. But we started writing new music. And then us and Alexis had that idea for the Switcheroo. So I don't remember timeline-wise if they were talking to Vagrant. Maybe they were just talking to Vagrant, but I don't know. You will have to do some fact-checking on that. We'll have to pull up some info on that. But anyways, that recording, actually, that Switcheroo recording ended up being one of our most fun recordings we had would ever done.
So that, like, what's funny is that was 2005, so I was 15. So for years, I assumed that every split bands put out involved them covering each other's songs.
Well, those are the best ones.
That's what I thought. I was like, every split means this band covers that band's songs. Because so where did you guys record that? Did you do that with Gerg?
Yeah, we did that with Gerg. Because you know what, actually, I think the thing is we were starting to do demos for Red Tree at that point.
Oh, okay.
Like no more touring. We had done all the touring you could want to do for a record. So we really were buckled down, and we started writing in Eric, our bass player's parents' basement. That's kind of became our headquarters. And I remember we were demoing at the time, so we wanted to go to Gerg's and do some demos, and then this Alexis thing came up, and we're like, hey, we should cover each other's songs. And I don't know where the actual... It spawned from a joke. I don't know what the joke was. I can't remember, but there was a joke, and that's what launched this whole thing. But I'll tell you, the biggest inspiration for me was I got a 7-inch in, like, late 90s or, like, you know... Sometime 98 or something like that, maybe. Anyways, a split with the Get Up Kids and Coalesce.
Oh yeah,
and it was just a split 7-inch, and it's still my one of my. I would say it's probably that, and there's a old Jimmy World 7-inch I have. That those two would be my favorite 7-inches, and Get Up Kids, it's one of my favorite Get Up Kids songs. Actually, now that I think about it, is the cover that they did at Coalesce, and I always thought that was so cool. I thought it was great. So, anyways, when this joke spawned this thing, we were going to be recording these demos with Gerg. So we're like, hey, Gerg, do you mind if we record this split as well? Yeah, yeah, okay, when do you have time? I got time, I don't know, in like 3 weeks or something. Okay, cool, that'll be good, all right. So now we're like heavy, heavy jamming every single day. I'm jumping on BMX, I'm riding down Williams Parkway, going over to Center Street, busting into Eric's place there and his parents every single day. And it was like this real great magical time of like just like immersing yourself in creative music, not just like playing your songs, but just like every day you're no longer practicing as much as you're creating. It was like a wicked time. So we really got lost in that. And we started doing a lot of our own demos. That's kind of when I just really, really jumped into recording. So anyways, we're jamming. We get a call from Gerg, and hey, dude. Yo, Gerg, what's happening, man? He's like, you ready for the studio, dude? And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, we got to write a few more songs, thinking he's talking about, like, long ways away, some joke about recording what will be Red Tree. So now I'm making jokes like, oh, we got some more songs to write. He's like, what do you mean you got some songs to write? Like, dude, you come in the studio tomorrow. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you book studio time tomorrow for the Alexis split. I was like, oh, yeah, man, I know. I'm just kidding. Anyways, what time you want us in there? 10 o'clock. Okay, yeah, I'll see you there. And I hang up the phone, and I was like, oh, my God, dudes, we forgot that we're recording the split tomorrow. Everyone, they're all like, what? Yeah, dude, what the hell? Fuck.
Wait, have you even played the songs yet then? Like, the covers you're going to do?
No.
That's insane.
We knew we wanted to do Accidents. We knew that for sure. But we didn't know what we wanted to do for a second one. And... so anyways, we had to figure it out in a real hurry. And so we figured out Accents pretty quick. That one came together pretty quick. We did, like, you know, we had fun with it. We tried to poke fun at little parts we could poke fun at, and, like, you know, just like, cause we're not, you know, I don't know. Anyways, it's like, it was a very, very fun mission, playing a song like that. Like, but then when it came to the second one, well, we are going to do this, I can't remember what song it's called, but one of the songs that we were in the video, we were going to do that song just because we felt like we had a connection, but we really couldn't get anything going. So that's why we decided to do that instrumental. So we went in the next day, like, knowing, okay, we got to pull this off. But, like, it was like when you put a project off when you're in school and, like, you know you're about to blow it, but then you just, like, kick into, like, high gear, you stay up all night, and then you actually like get something rad going. Well, that never happened for me in school. I never made anything rad. I would just basically barely hand it in, and I would get like maybe 50%. But this time we went and we had so much fun because we had no expectations. We just knew kind of what we wanted to do. So that kind of like put us in this like really great headspace. Like there was this one time near the end. This is when we were like, okay, we're probably done recording these songs. We started running a bath. We got Gerg to run a bath for us so Hippie and I could get in the bath and splash around, and we would record it for ambient noise in one part of the song. And that's when we realized, and Gerg was doing it. He was getting ready. And then that's when we realized, you know what? Maybe the recording's done when we're recording bath scenes in it. But it really... So out of that too, we had the Bleed and Blister song,
yeah, version two,
because we had already recorded a version of it, and you know, we made some significant changes to the song. So anyways, but it really put us on this path. Like we kind of, after we did that switcheroo split, we kind of knew what direction we're going with the next record. Because we were really, like, I'll tell you some of the early demos, like, especially, or at least songs that were carrying on from Really Happy that I thought might be next record songs. Like, I remember, like, us going through the demos and being like, whoa, like, there's some rough songs here. Like, some, like, real stretches to try and get something going. But, but Bleed and Blister really, and then that switcheroo just really put us on a... We were just in the zone from that point. So then, now we had to get some demos together. So now we had Bleed and Blister, a really good sounding song. We started talking to producers. Now, I never boast about things. I feel like I'm quite humble, but there's something that happened during this part of the process that I think back to quite often as like a pretty cool experience, which was we start talking to different producers. Because Really Happy, Trevor Keith and Chad Blindman did the record, and we went to California to do it. This time we weren't opposed to traveling, but we didn't want to necessarily travel across like North America to get to where we have to record. But we were really open to just seeing who might be interested and who we might be able to have some fun with and bounce some ideas off of. But we were shooting real high. We really did. We weren't being too humble at that moment, I guess, because we shot the demo out or demos out to some like pretty cool producers that I would think would never even give us the time of day. But we talked to some like really nice, interesting, talented people. But this we sent it to this guy named Ken Andrews, which is one of the guys in the band Failure, which has been one of my favorite bands forever since the 90s. And they're this amazing space rock band. And he's incredible. So anyways, we shot it out to him, and he ends up being pretty interested and enough to talk to me a couple times. So even for me at that point, when I'm getting to talk to one of like my like musical heroes, I was like, oh, you know what? Like, even if we break up and never even record this record, I just got to talk to Ken Andrews about bass tone. It's the best. Like, it was such a crazy time. Like, so many like cool experiences kept happening. But anyways, in the end, we got put in touch with Brian McTernan. He was an incredible producer, and he's from the Baltimore area. And he has done probably every one of our favorite records from, you know, like late 90s to like early 2000s. Like he did like
Hot Water.
Like amazing Hot Water music, some great Thrice records, Hot Rod Circuit, which is like...
He was like the Vagrant guy for a long time there.
Yeah. He did a lot of records, but he did Circus Survive as well. Like he's done some like really like the most important record that because here's the thing, like when we got together with him... everyone always asks him about Hot Rod music, but the only thing I want to talk about was Cave In Jupiter.
I didn't realize he did Jupiter.
Yeah, that's the only that was when I found out that I was gonna have a phone call with the guy who recorded Cave In Jupiter. I was just like, oh my gosh, this is the best day ever. And
that big record where they changed the sound a lot, right? Right one. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. They went from like tech metal into like just big like
big rock,
Rush
almost.
Rush influenced space rock, like with but that's a huge record. So anyways, we got together on the phone, and me and Brian started talking, and something that I thought was really interesting, because we were really guarded when it came to our music. Like, I remember, I think back to like recording Really Happy, and Trevor, some of the suggestions he made were actually very, very good suggestions, but I know we were stubborn about it. Like, I know we were real stubborn, and I knew that about us going into this next record, but we really wanted another set of ears. Like, we wanted some, not necessarily, we didn't want someone to come in and like give us ideas, because we had lots of ideas, but we wanted someone to help us sort through these ideas. So the idea of a producer, we're really embracing it, and I always really enjoyed my time in the studio. So for me, it was like, you know, it was important that you find someone that you connect with, and me and Brian right away we started having really great phone conversations, and the thing that like really like took me is that he like talked about lyrics right away. Like one of the first things he talked about was lyrics, and I was just like, it almost made me feel uncomfortable. I remember when anyone would ask me about lyrics before that, it would like make me a little uncomfortable. Like, you feel kind of vulnerable, right? But I kind of just gave into it. I was like, well, he's asking, I'm gonna talk to him about it. And we really made this awesome connection. And so Vagrant decided they... Now, it seems like the lead up to us actually recording this record is quite long, but there is an important part here that really led to the record becoming what it was, which was just pre-production, which is normally not a very interesting part to talk about. It's like, you know, like, it is cool if you're in a band, you know, like the Beatles documentary that just got put out.
Yeah, it was wild.
That's an amazing thing to watch, right? Like, getting to see how different artists tackle their art, and it's pretty inspiring. But this was a whole different experience. So we went to Beltsville, I think it was called, Beltsville? His original Salad Day studio was in between Baltimore and D.C.
Is that the barn?
Yes. Yeah, okay, yeah. There was a house, and then off to the side was this converted, barn sort of garage space. And it was wicked. It was awesome. So we had, like I said earlier, we had a bunch of demos. But thinking back to them, they weren't... Some of them were good. Some of them made it and actually ended up pretty much the same. But there was a couple in there that were like... I think back to them, I was like, whoa. Like, seriously? We were like, that. Those are the songs we were bringing to the table? But we knew. We knew which ones were strong and which weren't. So when we got there and we were like, okay, let's take a week and we're just going to work on these songs with Brian. And we're going to record... I think we're going to record three of them. So right away, I was like, okay, these two, forget it. Let's just work on these ones. And then we start working on them. And weirdly, a little side story to this is that we were running into, like, not issues or anything, but just, like, I kept feeling like songs were trying to be changed, like, just to change them. Like, you know, we kept chopping songs up, and I really, my gut was telling me that, like, it feels pretty good the way it is, but, like, I'm going to try this. I'm going to go along with it. And anyways, that part of the experience was like a little weird. It's not what we like thought what we were going to get into, and it frustrated some people in the band. And so one day Brian and I went out for lunch, and I remember just like sitting down. I was just kind of like, this feels weird, and I'm not used to relationships with people feeling weird. I try to like very hard to like make people feel good as well as like, you know, feel comfortable myself as well. So like, anyways, we go to this lunch, and straight up, I was like, Brian, this feels a little weird. What's going on? How come we're changing so much stuff? And then he admitted, he's like, you know what? I've been thinking about this all day today, too. I'm really glad we're doing this. I think Vagrant got in my head a little bit. This is not exactly what he said, but to summarize. And they basically were like, hey, we're really excited for this band and this release. I think they need some, like, you know, get in there, like, really produce these songs. So it kind of got put in his head that, like, oh, I'm going to go produce these songs. So it's funny, after that lunch, when I was like, you know what, like I thought sometimes it felt like we're changing things to change them, but he's like, okay, you know what, let's go back to everything the way it was. Let's just start from scratch. We were there for 2 weeks. The first week was weird. The second week, it was the best. And that's what really, really solidified what Red Tree was going to turn into. Because then he wasn't trying to make us be anything we were except for Monique. It was just, he got it. Like, that one lunch changed everything. And then, you know, from then, me and Brian have been real good friends and still stay in touch. I just ran into him a little while ago, and he's got this new band, Be Well, that is just killing it. And it's just like, it really
is
like
super group.
The super group, have Schleibaum in it, and
yes, okay,
I ran into Brian recently, and it was so good seeing him. So we have these demos, and now we send them back to Vagrant, and now we know, okay, 100%, this is the guy we need to work with. He's like, me and him just got along so great, and so we send the demos back to Vagrant. They were super, super stoked, and now it's on. Okay, let's do it. We're going to record the record. So now it's time for us to take what we kind of like honed in on that pre-production and use it to finish the record. And the rest of the record wrote itself real quick. Blah, 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 blah. You know, we jam as much as we can in Eric's basement. His dad comes down occasionally to tell us if he likes things or if he doesn't. He was the silent executive producer. One of the songs he called Two Ton Thumper, which he really liked. He's like, oh, that Two Ton Thumper, that's a keeper. That one's going to end up on the radio. We're like, well, none of them are going to end up on the radio, yeah. but we appreciate it. We appreciate it a lot. So we were then scheduled to go to Baltimore to a new studio, to Brian's new Salad Days. It was moving from Beltsville, I think it was called. And then we are going to be, the first recording in his new studio, which, side note, which we didn't realize meant that there were still going to be workers working on the studio, grinding metal and doing weird shit all the time. But it was a rad place, and it was totally like world-class, sort of like, we don't deserve to be here kind of studio, you know, like, I wish I could remember the exact board. I think he had a Neve at the time, but I might be wrong about that, but it was like a, it was a super sweet place. Like the live room was amazing. And he had living quarters right in it. And it was in a pretty cool area. Fells Point, I think it was called, which is kind of near the water. It's kind of like a little weird art district. And right down the road, actually, was this bread factory. So if you're walking around, you always knew kind of like how to get back to the studio because you just
follow the smell.
Yeah. Yeah, follow the bread smell. There was also another shop down the road from, what is his name? I'm not going to remember it. Some real weird artsy film director. Like he did some of the real strange movies. I wish I could remember who it was. John Waters, I think his name is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He had a shop right down the road that Hippie and Eric used to go visit in there, and just because he would talk about weird things. And so we show up to the studio and we have these songs. Me and Brian had been working, you know, sending demos back and forth, and the songs were ready. Like we were very, very prepared. And so we go start recording, and it was like a very different experience from any older Monin recording. One, I think just because of the way the studio was just like felt like this like studio that we almost didn't deserve to be in. Like it kind of made us like step up even more. I remember Peter just, he killed it. He went in there and just like, he wasn't like, you know, having to struggle against a click and like try and get in the zone for the songs. He was just like playing the songs and having fun with them. And like, that just made it like, you know, even more fun for us to like lay that foundation down, you know, when there's like a super good 100, just amazing positive vibe. Like it just, if it starts like that, like most of the time it's going to keep rolling. So the record came together like quite quick, actually. But the funny thing was Brian is a very busy person. Like he was recording our record. I think he was starting to talk to another band about doing another record. But on top of that is the studio build that he was still like, he's like the main kind of like foreman for it. But he was also doing home renos at the same time. So he was like the busiest man I've ever seen in my life. But, and I think to some bands that probably wouldn't have worked out so well. The fact that he needed to leave the studio at certain times, he needed to get on the phone occasionally. And it was never disruptive. I want to be clear. It was never disruptive because that's right when I was like getting super, super into recording myself.
Yeah. So you were interested in everything that was happening.
Oh yeah. I was right there beside him. I was like, I want to learn everything. And it got to a point where he trusted us enough that he started to leave the studio when he wanted to leave the studio, which to us was too early because we wanted to just we were that kind of band that like would just jam constantly all the time. We just wanted to always be playing. Like, you know, if you're in the studio, like you want to be picking up a guitar and playing when you're not playing. Like, so for us, it was just like, they felt like short days. So he's like, well, why don't you do this? If we're set up on a tone, bass, for instance, was the first time it happened. He's like, I gotta go. Why don't you, Kenny, I trust you. Why don't, just take the controls. Don't do anything wild. Don't change anything, but just go record as much stuff as you want. And I'll come back the next day. And if there's stuff that's cool, great, we'll keep it. If not, whatever, we'll just redo it. So he's like, I trust you. So that opened a huge door. And we ended up recording, I think me and Eric pretty much recorded all the bass that night.
Yeah.
And Brian came back, was like, what the fuck? You guys recorded all the bass? We're like, yeah, pretty much. We got one little part that we needed like a crazy fuzz sound for, so we stopped there. Like, it was like, he's like, whoa, okay, all right. So then it kept going like that. We would like get super creative with him, and because we really would, we had tons of ideas, and we had like a lot of like roomy drum sound ideas and some like different guitar ideas. And we obviously at that point we were like full on loved delays more than anything, and we were just on this quest for like making weird sounds. And it was cool because here's the difference, because when we recorded Really Happy, we didn't do that record live off the floor as a band, but Hippie and I played the guitar parts together live off the floor, sort of, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, and that was really kind of what we're used to when doing demos and things like that. But so this time we got to like sort of really experiment separately. Which was kind of cool, because then like a lot of weird little magic moments happen, especially delay wise. Cause like Hippie would do, you know, if your boy lays down a crazy delay part and your part's coming up next, well, how inspiring is that? Right? Like
yeah.
It should be, you give your pal space, so then their delay part can shine. Like, no, we were trying to outshine people, each other the whole time. But so we worked like that a lot. We would work with Brian throughout the day, and then we would have a sound that was set, and we would kind of go with it and have some fun during the night. And I remember there were some evenings of lyric writing. I remember not being completely finished with lyrics and having to do some secretly stressful lyric writing at night in the studio. And you know, that's the funny thing for me personally, like Hippie is an amazing singer. He's very comfortable singing in a studio. And for me, like, I know, like, I'm not a bad singer, but I'm also not a trained singer at all. Like, I've never been a great singer, but I'll sing with heart. That's for sure. So I remember getting close to vocals and like getting sort of like a little stressed, but like, we really did. We had these like super long days, but every day ended with like complete total, sometimes exhaustion, but like a lot of happiness. Like, we were always so stoked with what we were doing every day. But the funny thing is like, while that was happening, we got into the show, The Wire, which takes place in Baltimore.
In Baltimore, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love The Wire.
It's the old HBO show. And they were filming just before we got there. And we would find these, The Wire, like spray-painted signs put up with arrows pointing crew where to get, because they're filming all over the city. So anyways, we got super into The Wire, and it became this this like
treasure hunt almost.
Kind of, yeah. We were finding like locations and stuff. So it kind of became like we would record or watch The Wire. And I think there was a video game Eric was playing pretty constantly. Fable, I think. Kind of like some sort of fantasy sort of Xbox game. Anyway, so and Hippie would, you know, Hippie's always kind of been my sidekick when it comes to like recording stuff. Like, we're always kind of, you know, in the studio. I pretty much never left the studio. I left once, actually. I left for a couple hours one afternoon near one of the last days, because I had to go get some Christmas presents. And it was the only chance I got. So I decided, okay, I'm going to go. And Brian was like, just go, man. Honestly, you don't need to be here every second. But I was like such a little, like, not a control freak, because I wasn't like a, like, it wasn't a negative thing, but I was really, really focused on what we were doing. And I really felt like there was some, like, different songs for us on that record.
Yep.
Like, I don't, I don't remember the names of all of them too well, to be honest. We had jam names, which I remember, and but there's this one song on it that stands out for me being like, it was like a challenge, like it was The East Is Stolen What the West May Want, I think it's called.
Yep, yep.
And that's definitely like one of the real different ones on the record. But I just remember how cool that experience was. We tried that song like many different ways. Like I remember like feeling like a not as good Radiohead on the, because we would try like really completely different versions of that song. And we'd never done anything like that before. Usually like if a song's born a certain way, that's just, it's how it is. And you fight your way through it to like get it how you want it. But this was really like taking a step back, and it was super cool. But I think like probably my favorite, if I'm really thinking back, my two favorite like moments about different experiences were the very last song, Song I Swore, is that what it's called?
Yep, Song I Swore to Never Sing, yeah.
And then there's another one, Million Reasons. Those two were actually my favorites to record, being selfish and just talking about what I like.
See, that's interesting to me, because those are the two that stand out immediately in terms of not being like a usual Moneen song or even with the rest of the record. They're kind of on the tail end, where, you know, some people might say with some records that's where you tuck the ones you're maybe unsure about. And I definitely think, listening back to this again, I listened to this a bunch again this week, where it was like tracks 1 to 6 when I was a lot younger, unbeatable. Those were my 6 favorite songs on the record.
Okay, you like the first half.
Yeah, and now as I'm older, I was like, okay, I see the value, especially as a front-to-back listening experience. When you get to the, if it kept going from Frightening Reality onwards, if we didn't get a little bit of a breather there, we'd be in rough shape.
No, you need some space in your life, man. No, it's funny. Like we had a good idea of the journey we wanted that record to be, like you know, sequence wise, how we wanted to like we really do. But you know what? If I think back to like a lot of my favorite records, a lot of them have that second half kind of more spacey, artsy, doing a little different vibe to it. Because, you know, in our head, it was like we kind of built it like we would want to, like a live show sort of in a way, like, which was always like come in, explode, roll around on the ground for a while, take a breather, rest, maybe make a couple people cry, and then you know, go back into it. But that song with that piano song that ended up being the last song on the record, I think it was just, it was not a thing of like not knowing where to put it. Where does it need to go in this record? More just like, it just felt kind of cool to end the record in this like really quiet, beautiful way rather than a big explosion is like how we would want, like, you know, a really impactful, usually epic ending is what we're looking for. But this time, I think there was even a second where we were talking about opening the record with that piano song, which I don't think that would have been a good idea. I think that would have been us just trying to be like Jimmy Eat World Clarity, opening the record with like a quiet song. But I think where it ended up at the end, I think was pretty, I don't know, pretty fitting. It's just like to me, whenever we would, like, when I remember when we put that record on and got to listen to it after it was mastered, and it was like when it was done, I just felt like, it feels so complete. Like, it feels like that's it. That's all. That's everything right there. But it was great. We, you know, me and Hippie had some like really amazing creative times, like pushing ourselves, like with sounds on that. And we wanted to do it, like, we wanted to make it real. We didn't want to like dial up a weird delay sound that you could only punch in to do. Like, we did a lot of that, like, just playing our parts off the fly. Like, it was a. Yeah, I still think we got some pretty cool sounds on that record.
Okay, there's some stuff I gotta hit from the beginning here. Is there a Bleed and Blister version 1 ever released anywhere, or is it just something you guys had, or was there even I almost see it like this could have definitely been a Moneen joke where they release something called version 2 and there is no version 1. People keep looking for it. And that's
yeah,
the
no,
gag.
That's that could possibly be it. But no, I'm pretty sure. See, I think the difference was, and I wish I knew. I wish I had a better memory for this kind of stuff. But one version had a long kind of spacey middle, pretty typical going off on a...
Version 2 has that on the switcheroo, okay. Where version 3 on the red tree, you tightened up. You got rid of that part. It almost gets spacey for a short period. You go right okay. into that build-up and back into the da-da-da-da,
so,
like fairly
okay.
quick.
My guess would be version 1... Now I'm going to have to really search for this. Because I do have the hard drives.
I've been thinking about this for like 16 years. So this
is if I were going to guess in Moneen style, that version 1 would have been even longer and way more weird.
Okay.
I think we would have reeled it in a little bit by version 2 and then version 3.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think we would have started with like a Green Day sounding version in version 1. I think it would yeah. have been like Space Odyssey version.
Yeah, yeah. 11 minutes. But. Yeah. And then the other thing, I just want to remark how truly insane it is that you guys only really put one day's worth of work into that split. Because to me, when I listened to that split, I was like, man, these guys must have got together years before. Yeah, the switcheroo, and been like, we're going to do this. You guys are going to do these two songs. We're going to do these two songs. And then it sounds like you chipped away at it for hours and made these versions that were still true to the originals, but so, so completely different by the time they make it on the recording.
Yeah, I think we just left it so last minute that there was no thinking. It was just do. Just
That's
just,
so wild. And yeah, how yeah. good that recording sounds. Like, for people who don't know, when we say Gerg, it's a guy, Greg Dawson. He's yeah. a recording engineer. He was out of Brampton. Now he's out of Kingston.
Kingston, BWC Studios.
Yeah, both one of our favorite people we've ever met. That's how I met you, through him.
Yeah, yeah.
This was when you were deep into recording as well. You just came to basically check out our session, then you ended up singing on the EP, and that was the first time we kind of hung out. But that was
those days were great. Gerg would call me, because I live close enough to Gerg that he would call me if there was like something he thought of was like, oh yeah, this is something Kenny could do. He would just call me, hey dude, can you come to the studio? I got this band. I think you could maybe do whatever. Like, a lot of times actually, I would go and do guest vocals for metal bands a lot, because Gerg would hear like a scream, like a section, and he's like, oh, this
Kenny could do this.
This could use a Kenny scream, and a Kenny scream was like I could never sing in a scream band. I would lose my voice immediately. But I have the ability for a one strange kind of, I don't know, it sounds like a freaking demon attacking like a bunch of dogs or something. I don't know, but anyways, and he had this little gold mic that he would plug into a distorted amp, and and I would usually stand on something or collapse to the ground and then just do this part. And it was so funny because I would come in like all polite and nice, like, hey guys, how you doing? I'm Kenny. Nice to meet you. And they would have no idea. All they knew is Gerg's like, yo, I got to call Kenny. He's got to do this scream. So I'd end up like on the ground with this gold mic just screaming my face off. And I remember like always coming back in the studio, and the bands would always be like, what the hell is wrong with you?
It's funny because we were actually booked to record somewhere else, and it fell through the week before. And then I was just on MySpace looking for studios, and I was like, shit, this guy's worked with Moneen. Let's go to this guy. That's
oh,
how we
no
found
way.
Gerg.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
I think at the time it was like he had just listed like Smaller Chairs. Did he do Smaller Chairs?
Yeah, Greg Dawson did Smaller Chairs at his original studio that he worked with this real great dude, Steve Donahoe, Stevie D, called Harlow Sound.
Okay.
It's like in Etobicoke, Mississauga area. That's kind of where they like cut their teeth, as I guess you'd say. Like, and then Gerg did Theory, our first full length, and we did that in Toronto at, oh, darn. This is bad. This is real bad if you can't even remember.
I've been like 20-something years ago, so don't feel too bad.
Anyways, a Chemical Sound, I think it was called, Chemical Sound in Toronto.
Yeah.
I think there was two versions of it. That was the first version. And that was a cool experience. I know we're talking about Red Tree, but that was a cool experience with Gerg, because I think that was one of his first times like going to another studio since he'd had his own. And it was all to tape. We did it all two-inch tape, and we mixed it down to half-inch. But the funny thing is, is at the end of that record, to just really get off course for a second here, at the end of that record, it sounds like there's like this man talking, and there's all this weird noise part, and it sounds like it's a, like exploding kind of at the end, and I really wanted to sound like it was dying, and we tried multiple different things, and this is for audio nerds out there like me. We really wanted to like naturally break this tape up, so we took it and we took the actual, we spliced off a piece of the reel, the mix master or the half inch, and scrumpled it all up, and then spliced it back on, and listened to it, and we were waiting, oh man, this is going to sound crazy. It didn't sound anything. It sounded perfect. Oh fuck, spliced it off again, and we take it, and now we took, I took keys, and I wrapped around the keys, and I started like pulling it. I'm like, oh, all right, this is going to fucking do some weird shit. Put it on there. Nothing. It was perfect. No, couldn't hear any, like, nothing happening. So then anyways, I was like, okay, splice it one more time. Give it to me, scrumple it up, I throw it on the ground in a pile, and now I just take these fridge magnets and throw them into the pile and just rub it all together. And I remember the engineer, Rudy, was like, whoa, okay, that's, I think we're, I think we may get an effect here, but he's like, I think that might just erase everything. I don't know. We're like, okay, we splice it on, and it sounded like the world was ending. And when Small Man sent it out to get pressed, the CDs to get pressed, the manufacturing people called them back three times saying, hey, we need to let you know there's something wrong with your master here. It's like peaking, clipping, it's exploding, like something is wrong. I'm like, no, that's the way it's supposed to be. Then it goes on to the next step, and then someone else is like calling their supervisor, yo, something's wrong. So anyways, I thought that was a great goal to achieve, to freak out the manufacturer so much that they had to call about it. But that's the thing though, man. Just experimenting is my favorite. It's just like getting with your pals and just trying weird things. Like, yes, we don't take ourselves too seriously, but we took our songs very seriously. Like,
and, that's interesting, because I wanted to kind of, one of my questions, because I've seen you guys live so many times, and especially when I was younger, that was really the first like exposure I had to anyone using a delay pedal, let alone each of you having multiple on your board running together into each other at the same time. But it was controlled, or at least from the outside it seemed very controlled and purposeful. I know there's definitely a lot of experimentation, but and with Brian it was interesting when you said he was trying to almost overproduce initially, you worked it out. One of my questions was kind of, how did your guys' natural sort of just the way you guys work, the way you guys play, how much of that did he try and shape, or did he really just start to embrace it and let you go? Because this record specifically, I would use the word controlled, in terms of where the guitar parts are absolutely awesome and super cool, the riffs,
thank you.
Like, but it's always harnessed, like it's always its best. It's never too much or washed out or just completely over the top and wild. Like, how much of that was Brian and how much of that was just how you guys focused on this record?
Yeah. Well, first off, thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words. A lot of that was Brian figuring out how to capture us being us, but also in the way he likes to record records. So most of it I would give Brian credit for, and it's still to this day recording techniques and how to balance guitars that I'm still doing from learning from that session. And but we also writing it, we had a different vision too. Like, we weren't thinking controlled, but that's a very good way to put it. Like, really happy and even theory before that, there was absolutely no rules to songwriting. In fact, we were probably trying to go against any rules that we thought was involved in songwriting. So when it came to Red Tree, I think I also was in a different place. I was listening to a lot of different music, and I was starting to get into songwriting more. Before, it was just like picking parts out of the sky or and then trying to use them. And if you can do that, and things come together. Like, that's how we wrote songs before. That's why parts were weird and there was a lot of like pretty wild out there guitars. But this time we were like, we kind of got into more focused songwriting, like as far as like, instead of like, how about we don't step all over each other as guitar players? Like, how about we like try to like actually like, you know, rein some things in a little bit? And I say that, and mind you, I know how ridiculous that is, because in the Monin world, reining things in is still not really reining things in. Like, it's, you know, it's still me and Hippie are playing lots. But anyways, we came into the recording and into that pre-production like wanting to get there, but not really knowing how yet. And I think Brian, once we figured it out, Brian really figured how to do that. Okay, these guys, like, they don't want to chop their parts up. They want to like play these songs, but we're not going to do it live off the floor, because we have a lot of time. And he really wanted to like experiment with sounds and stuff. So I would give Brian a lot of credit for kind of figuring out how to like keep these wild animals contained in their enclosures. You know, like that's kind of like, well, sort of what it was, because we have. But you know what? Here's the best thing I learned from Brian that I've passed on many times myself, is that it takes more time to argue with someone why they shouldn't try something than just trying it. Because, you know, like I remember the first time because I gave him a lot of credit. I was like, dude, you really don't hold us back here. Like, any weird idea you're in. He's just like, well, like, sure. Like, and then he said that. And I was just like, that's the smartest thing someone could say. Like, and it's true. We did. We tried everything. Not everything worked. Definitely not everything worked. But a lot of things did. A lot of things that would... a lot of things I remember there was some resistance. I could tell there was some resistance. You know, not just from like... Am I still going here? Okay. Sorry. My bad. I thought something stopped. But we did. We explored a lot of pretty weird things on that recording. I think for sure so one of us was naked recording something at some point, because we thought it would just add to the tension. I don't know. We were weirdos.
Yeah. I think the best example is the ending of Fright and Reality, as the riff carries on and then it starts to detune and warp and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I think the average listener would think, oh, studio trick. But then they see the band live and it's like, that's the kind of stuff you guys are doing live. This is like,
yeah,
these transitions, these weird parts, these detunings, these warpings, like... You guys, that's when I say control, that's what I'm thinking of. Like, there was a very, like, it was on the record and it was in the live show. And the biggest difference for me from Happy to this was you found control and structure.
Yeah.
Like, you really, like, hey, let's do a song where it's verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, done. Which, you know, never would have really been a Monin thing before.
No.
But we get some here and it's awesome. I think it works great.
Yeah. I know what you mean. No. I'm thinking back to it. We really would, in older records, we would just hit a part of a song where most bands would do a bridge and then come back to the chorus. And we would be like, okay, here, let's go take another. Oh, did we just take a left turn? No, we're going to do a U-turn. Then we're actually going to just go in this traffic circle a few times. We're going to go up that hill off-road, and then we're going to come back. But we're never going to go back to that town we started in. We're going to end up in a whole different place. And then, like, that was part of the journey. But you're right. That's what I was trying to say in the focus part. We're trying to like consciously at some points. Now, mind you, we also were doing that. But again, I mean, a Monin bridge was never just a normal, you know, two bar simple little bridge. No. And then go back to the song. Like, but I will say, like, everything, once we got in, that's why I was like saying, once we found our path, once we figured out where we wanted these songs to go, and there was some weird ones on there, we knew that, it came together pretty natural, and capturing it was like so much fun.
Was there, going into recording, sometimes did you have a song maybe going in you thought, we might cut this one, and it ended up being great? Or maybe you had one that you're like, oh shit, I'm really excited about this, but when you record it, we're like, it didn't really take the form I thought it would.
Yeah, you know what? Some definitely happened where we weren't feeling as strong about it beforehand. None of them went the other way. I'm happy about that. Like, none of them went where it's like, this kind of sucks. You know, in the end, like, Like, there was a couple songs that we weren't feeling strong about that definitely, like that Frightening Reality song. That was one of the ones I was really struggling with lyrics-wise. Like, I just, it just didn't, it was a real last-minute complete change, I remember. Changing up lyrics, changing melodies, and I really second-guessed myself with that one. But as I was starting to sing it, and as it was starting to come together, I realized, whoa, this song is like, and even lyrically, started to mean something like real different to me. And I don't know what people's favorites are off that record, but as far as the more like rock songs go, like, I think that's a pretty wicked song.
Definitely.
Say that without sounding like a jerk.
No, I think it's definitely, well, the first three hit so hard as well. Like, that three is such a great run.
Right, Lock, off the hop. Tragedy, Bleed. Yeah. Is that the first three?
Yep,
there?
First three. And then you chill it out a bit with Day No One Needed to Know.
Yeah,
little bit chill. This Is All Bigger Than Me. And then boom, when that do-do-do-do-do-do, that crazy riff comes and it starts, it's right back up and going
so
again.
So when Kenny got introduced to a whammy wah pedal, and all he wanted to do was use a whammy wah pedal.
Yeah. And so the first song, Don't Ever Tell Locke, so I assume you're a big Lost fan.
Huge. It was a problem here for me for a while, I think.
Yeah, I've got two.
Were you super into it too?
Oh, I've got two Lost tattoos. I had three.
Oh, yes.
I had three, but the third one was the numbers. And the week I got the numbers, I got rear-ended. I got my first smartphone, iPhone 4. Brought it home. It was a total brick, dead right under the box.
Oh my gosh.
And then I went to take it back to the store, and as I was biking back from the store, I got hit by a car on my bike. This is all the first like week and a half of having the numbers tattooed on me. So
dude,
I got them covered up.
Oh my god.
They're covered now, but I've got Desmond's face saying "See you in another life, brother," and I got Frank Lapidus saying "We're not going to Guam, are we?"
Oh my god, you're the best. That's incredible.
I remember seeing that title being like, hell yeah, like my two favorite things. Here we go.
See, I thought I was a super fan because I named my son Jacob. But I think you got me beat.
Yeah.
Jacob got to come. He was actually born on Lost Tuesday. Remember they used to air on Tuesdays?
Oh yeah, yeah.
He was born on Lost Tuesday, and we used to throw Lost parties at our house. Jacob was born technically past midnight, so on a Lost Tuesday, and everyone still came over for a Lost party, and
got to
watch
it.
Lost with this little newborn Jacob.
That's awesome. When exactly did Vagrant get involved in the process? I never kind of they're already on board. Switch, yeah,
yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. So
when
we,
and how
we started to the first record we did with Vagrant was Really Happy. So that was released on Vagrant Worldwide minus Small Man Records had Canada still. And so the quick story is we started to get to a point where we started to play in the States a little bit. And I guess we sort of started to get people's attention a little bit. And a very special person to us is this guy named Andrew Ellis, who is a booking agent from the States, and he booked basically all of our favorite bands from the emo scene, like Get Up Kids, Dashboard, Hot Rod, Saves the Day, like pretty much anyone you can think of, like he booked. So he weirdly somehow got a hold of, I don't know if it was a Theory record or what it was exactly, but he got hold of something early from us, and I don't even know if it was a whole record or not. But anyways, we get this call from this guy, Andrew Ellis, and we don't know who he is or much about him, but he explains and then says he's really into the band and he wants to help us out. So he puts us, at this point now, we're talking to different labels. We're talking to Hopeless, we're talking to Lookout, I think, had put out the Smaller Chairs EP. So we're starting to talk to different labels, sending our record out, and you know, there's a little bit of buzz happening, so it's like we're starting to get these meetings, which was always like, and the meetings would always go through you know, Small Man was our management, but I would end up talking to all these people. I was a very hands-on, talkative fellow. I, as you could tell, I was never haven't stopped talking this whole time, pretty much. But so we started to build this relationship with this Andrew Ellis, and at the time he was booking. At the time he was booking Get Up Kids, Saves the Day, Dashboard, Brand New, a band called Rufio. Anyways, it went on and on and on and on and on. And so he's telling us about this, like, and he's like, hey, I'd like you to, I want to put you on a show. I see you're doing some shows in the States. I want to put you on a show, and I want to invite the Vagrant people out, and I want you to play for Vagrant. And I'm like, what? It's like, okay. So he puts us on this show. It's actually an Alkaline Trio show, an underplay at this place in Anaheim, Chain Reaction, which is quite a famous place.
Yep.
He's like, I'm going to put you on this opening slot with Alkaline Trio, and I can't remember what the band was called, but the band right before Alkaline Trio was members of Texas Is a Reason and some other guys. I can't remember what the band was called. And we opened the show, and it was like this whole, there's this big deal. Vagrant's going to come see us play. We're going to play the show, blah, 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 blah. And there's a funny story that goes along with it, but you know, I won't go too long into it. But so we play the show, and it was really great, but we were still playing shows like we were a Brampton band, like doing things like a hall show, like unapologetically ourselves. Like, it was weird. I'll stop in the middle of a song and I'll start telling a story. Like, that's just where my head was at. We really felt like we had no rules when we played live, and especially playing like a lot of hall shows and stuff in Canada, and like shows starting to get bigger for us, but not bigger. We weren't really playing clubs. We were still just like playing primarily like punk rock shows. Like, if we played a club and there was a stage, we would sometimes ask to play on the floor. Like, we were just so used to playing on the floor with people around us. So like, our mentality was different. We were in a different zone. But then when you clash that with like a real punk rock scene that's like playing clubs, and kids are actually coming out to these shows, like, and you try to like combine those, sometimes it gets weird. So we play this show, and Kenny thinks it's a great idea mid-song to start telling a cat story about my cat like attacking my balls or something. Like, sure, if it was our show and it was like at a hall, that might be funny. You're opening up for Alkaline Trio and you're doing that, but that's the thing, that's where we were. We didn't care. But I just remember Ellis telling us how much he loved our band, how much he loved the songs, how good we were live. But he's like, why are you so goofy? Like, I was like, oh, bro, I guess you're right. I guess that was pretty goofy. But that started a whole thing, because it didn't scare everyone off enough to not get signed to Vagrant and not get booked by Ellis. And then, like I said earlier, with that 2003 year when we put out Really Happy, we were touring constantly. But mind you, again, I don't go around like bragging, but like, we played some amazing tours. We did like a Saves the Day and Taking Back Sunday tour that lasted like 2.5 months in the States. We played everywhere, and it was like, it was a different time too. Like, we really were lucky. We were very, very lucky being brought into that world that we looked up to so much. Like, Vagrant was, if there was a dream label for us to be on, it was Vagrant, 100%. Like, I think we've actually been really lucky with the labels we worked with. Being on Small Man for us at that point, like just starting out, we were huge Choke fans. Choke is like, for anyone that doesn't know Choke, they're still playing, and they are one of Monine's most influential bands, and they started off as like a tech punk skate band sort of, and then they morphed into, I think partially we might have been to blame to slowing them down a little bit and getting into delay pedals, but they became these best friends. But we also looked up to them as brothers, and like a band that had toured, and we didn't even know anything about touring. And so being on Small Man to us was super important, because we looked up to Small Man Records as much as we looked up to Vagrant Records. So for us to get on these two labels that were so, and still so important to me, whether we were on them or not, is pretty huge. Like, so anyways, it was like, pinched me, like, we got signed to Vagrant, what? Like, I was like, couldn't even believe when that was happening. But at the same time, like, it wasn't like I didn't feel like we're not worthy, because they were so welcoming. They brought us into that family immediately. Yeah. Oh, man, what an amazing time to think back on. This is really cool to do this, and, like, I mean, I'm breaking the eighth wall or whatever they call it, but this is really cool to do this, Kyle, because I don't get to, like, go back in time in my memories like this that much these days. There's just not too much reason to go back, you know, like, by myself, but, like, to get to talk to you about this such a special time for us is pretty cool. This is a...
There's a great podcast. I think it's Matt Pryor. Is doing, like, currently, it's still happening, a retrospective on Vagrant.
Oh,
for
the Vagrant, yeah, the Vagrant 25
and
podcast.
Like, listening to a lot of that stuff is echoing what you're saying about the label. It's funny when you talked about, because this is Brian McTernan did so much of that stuff. Like, the year you recorded, or the year this came out, 2006, he put out 7 records. Like, he was doing all this stuff, and he talked about, the Census Fail guys talk about, he would leave us a channel on the board. And he was like, at night, if you think of anything, this is your channel.
You record, he kept it going.
Yeah, you record on this channel, you know, ideas, whatever. And if it's cool, we just throw it right in. If not, at least I can hear it and understand what you're trying to do.
Yeah, beauty.
And we can do it up. So it's a cool trick. It sounds like he kept throughout.
That
podcast, they're talking, you know, this is the era. It saves the day. This is Get Up Kids. Alkaline Trio's exploding. Like, that whole label's just going wild.
Like, at that time years. when we got brought into that office for our first kind of getting to meet everyone at the label, I'll never forget. It was so I've always had an affinity for LA and California in general, but more specifically, not, I wouldn't say LA, but like the beaches and, like, you know, Santa Monica and all that kind of, like, I've always, when I was a kid, when I didn't know anything, like, so for, we ended up actually recording that really happy in a bunch of it in Santa Monica, but their office is, like, was in a pretty classic, like, LA area. Like, it felt like I was in, like, you know, like a, you know, an old action movie that I used to watch, that was based in LA, and like, you'd never know that this was a label, and you go and you step into these offices, and it was, like, so super cool and laid back, and everyone had their own space, but it was also, like, set up in this zone where everyone was together too. But, like, and we walked in, and immediately everyone was, like, welcoming us in before we were signed, welcoming us in like we were, like, one of their bands. Like, we were blown away by how loving they were. The whole place was filled with a giant blown up pics of the Vagrant America tour. They did those 4 nights in Chicago, which, funny enough, actually, this is how much of a fan I really was. Me and a few friends drove to Chicago to go see one or two of those Vagrant America shows. Which was so special to me at the time to get to see, you know, Get Up Kids were headlining, but Dashboard was playing when he was, like, first really blown up. Alkaline Trio was playing in their hometown. Saves the Day was playing, and it was when Chris was still just singing. And I didn't... I'm trying to think who else played that, but
Hot
I
Rod
didn't.
Circuit.
Hot Rod would have played too. Oh man, and Hot Rod, what's it called? Pharmacist. Oh, I'm blowing it right now. But anyways, the Sorry About Tomorrow. Oh, I'm throwing so many things out there. Anyways, the one with the girl on it. It's such an incredible record. It's by far my favorite Vagrant record they ever put out. Still to this day, I got to tour with Hot Rod again, and I watched them from side stage every night. Like, it was so good. But they, I was at that Vagrant America show just as a fan, and if someone had popped in my head and just been like, yo, you're going to be on the same label with these bands, and you're going to actually you're going to tour, but you and your band is going to get to know all these people up on the stage right now. Like, I would have never believed it, but, like, it was, like, really a dream come true, that whole experience. And they treated us so good. They really did.
And then, so, Vagrant's on board. This is it ends up being the second release. Now, thinking back to this time period, do you have a specific memory that kind of stands out from the Red Tree era, whether it be a certain tour or maybe even a show or just the time recording, like something, when you think back to the Red Tree, what's something that pops out as a really positive memory?
Well, that's tough. There's a lot, like, so many things were flashing. Like, I flashed back to me like some of the writing we did in Eric's basement and some of the growing pains we had figuring out what we were doing, what direction we were going, and trying to be too weird to be just weird. And with all these growing pains, I remember when it all came together and when me, Hippie, Eric, and Peter all like, it was like, oh, okay, we got it now. We know what we're doing. Like, there was some struggles when it came to like figuring out that record, because we had been thrown into this like new world. Touring became different. The shows we were playing became different. So we really were. We felt like we were getting like older a little bit. So it was like, there was some figuring out to do. I remember there was like a couple times in jams where it was like, you know, like things got a little weird. We went from like being in a van for like, you know, that whole cycle of Really Happy lasted probably like 3 years, and we were touring like pretty constant. So I remember though, when everything came together and then we started to really, really get it going, I just remember like we solidified like a real bond between us all. It was pretty cool.
Where did the album title come from, The Red Tree?
You know what? That's a weird one. I remember like, I remember working with the Vagrant graphics guy, their in-house dude. And I had some like visions. I don't know why. I kept going back to like, I had this thing about the snow. I don't know. I just kept thinking it was winter when we recorded it. So I'm not sure if that's what bled into it, but, I ended up just going, we were working with him and we couldn't get anything going. I didn't really like, and, I'm not really a great visual artist, but I'm like, I got a lot of ideas and I like graphic design a lot. So I've always had a hand in the design of the records and like the, you know, like laying it out and stuff like that. But like, I'm not a graphic artist. So anyway, so I just got kind of fed up with it and I just grabbed my camera and went out, up north, like from, Brampton and like where I used to live, and like, just went in the country, like in the farmland, and it was in the winter, and just started taking some pictures. And I never found a red tree, but I found a red bush. But I and it really caught me. And I think I don't know if it's on the CD or just the vinyl, but there's like, you'll see it. There's like this, like, I can't remember what the bush is called, but it's like the branches are bright red. It's like a pretty cool thing to see. It went green screen. I couldn't see it. But do you have the vinyl there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've
got you do? That's there. Wicked.
We're in a green screen of... Kenny put us in... What are we in? A jungle, it looks like, or something?
Oh, did I do this?
Yeah, this isn't
I thought
yet.
You did it. I thought this is the way you like to do it.
No. It was you changed the scene.
I don't know how I did that. Are you serious?
We've been sitting in this jungle the whole time.
I thought this is just the way you like to do your podcast.
Definitely not.
All right. Well, thanks for rolling with it with me. Okay. Oh, damn. Wait, sorry. What were we saying?
The red tree, basically getting the idea for the title.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So anyway, so I was taking all these pictures, and I really thought that image of, like, you know, just a snowy background with this, like, bright red bush was a really, like, moving image. Mind you can't call a record the Red Bush. Like, that's like a little suggestive and weird. So anyways, I did find some like lonely trees, and I think on that vinyl version you have there, I think that's the repress.
This is the Record Store Day one. Yeah.
So the I found some lonely trees, and I just thought there was something about like this one tree that's just sitting out here in the snowy field, just doing its thing, and like, it really was. It was like, it inspired me in a certain way. So I just kind of tied the two together and called it the Red Tree. But I remember like doing this, like, and I had a whole vision for it. And I got actually my godson's sister, and my godson to help me paint that red stripe. And I remember like having this whole vision. It seemed pretty grand to me, and I was going to have the snowy background, and I wanted these footsteps going out and make it look like they went out to nowhere. And I like did it. I like walked out and then walked, retraced my footsteps. So I had a pretty clear vision, but I remember like doing the presentation to the guys and Brian as well. okay, I got the record cover. I got it. Like, I've been working on it. I'm super stoked. Here we go. The record's going to be called The Red Tree, and here it is. I remember showing them, and it was basically like I didn't have the picture of the footstep yet, so it was just a white background with a red stripe, and it just said The Red Tree. And I remember everyone just kind of like, oh, is that it? I remember like, oh, like, oh, no, it's really cool. Like, you know, oh,
that's
don't
like,
worry.
That's like what you fear when you bring an idea to your band.
Yeah. But I think I hyped it up. Like, I was really stoked. But in the end, it turned out real great. And I don't think I have it in the room I'm in right now. But I have the original red stripe on a canvas.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That I did. And like, I have it. I've moved now, as I said, to Calgary for a little bit here. I'm pretty sure I brought it with me. I don't know where it is.
And Justin Ellsworth put it all together.
Yes. I love Justin, that guy, my man.
When we were on the label, that was like our guy.
Isn't he the best?
I was like, I'm not sure.
He loved you guys. I'm not sure if anybody really likes us here,
but I know this guy definitely does.
Yeah. Justin gets it. He's still lighting a fire under our asses occasionally when it comes to cool ideas. He's like we're working on something right now currently, actually, with Justin.
That's gonna be
pretty rad. And he is great, man. That's the thing, like we were really lucky, like same with Dying Alone. Like, I didn't mean to leave them out when I was talking about labels, but like we really, really lucked out when it came to our sort of like labels and sort of like the more like business side of things. We really did a quite a good job of being lucky enough to surround ourselves by some pretty awesome people, because like Small Man were family to us, Vagrant family to us, Dying Alone definitely family to us. Like, it was like, that's a pretty cool situation. I know lots of other bands that don't have that relationship with their labels, so I feel like we were lucky, but all, at the same time, like, we really put a lot into our relationships with people. Like, you know, people's feelings matter to us, so we wanted to work hard, we wanted to be respectful and nice, and but like I said, we were stubborn. I know we were definitely we were definitely really stubborn, for sure.
Do you remember what the reception was like when this album came out? Did you have expectations? Like, did you feel pressure? Do you feel like, oh shit, we really gotta step it up with this next one?
I don't know. I probably, the other guys would disagree if I said we weren't feeling too much pressure. I bet you I was feeling some pressure, but at least my memory serves me. It wasn't too much thinking about that kind of stuff. But we were confident, though. Like, we knew there were some pretty cool things happening, and I know Vagrant was very excited, and they had some expectations. I don't know if it met. Well, probably definitely didn't meet those expectations. But I remember things were changing a little bit then too, because like I remember bands. There was bands that would like you could still sell records, but by the time we signed a Vagrant, that was changing. Like, you weren't selling. Like, I remember they were like, yeah, you'll you know, we'll probably sell a certain amount of records by this point. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? Like, they're like, no, like going off of like, you know, some of our other bands that we've signed that we would like compare. So I think they had high hopes, and I don't think they were ever disappointed. But we didn't have too much expectation. We were just like pretty stoked to put out what we thought was like a good record. But like, we knew that there was some pretty cool stuff happening, but I think we are just a little always just too humble to like let that stuff go to our heads. Like, I don't know, at least I hope. Like,
yeah. No, I fully agree. I remember seeing you guys played the Starlight in Waterloo pretty soon after the release of this, and just destroyed the room. Like, and I'm pretty sure that
I remember that show.
The air conditioner was broken, I'm fairly certain, at this show, so it was like insanely hot.
I remember like people spilling over onto the stage a whole bunch.
Oh, yeah, I was getting crunched. Like, the bass part of Is It Tragedy? That's boom, 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 dem, boom, boom, boom. Like that, the big bass kind of slide at the beginning of the song.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's right.
I just remember everybody was just going nuts. But, like, I remember that era and being like, were you the only Canadian band at that point on Vagrant?
At that point, yeah.
Because, yeah, it seemed, I remember it seeming so crazy, being like, oh, this huge, huge label, this band I've seen a million times.
When we signed to Vagrant, it was really like a pretty wild, unique time for a Canadian punk rock band. Like, it was really like, wait, what's happening? And I remember, like, it was the first time that, like media kind of, like, picked up on us. Like we always kind of, like, added some good luck in, like, the college world. Like college papers would do little things on us when we come through different parts of Western Canada. And, like, but we never got any, like, huge, like love when it came to media because we were just a bit of a weird band. We didn't expect it. But when that Vagrant thing happened, I remember, like now an exclaim, like, both, like, we were on the cover of both of those at the same time, and, like, I remember thinking, like, what is going on? But it was like people were, like, really, like, got it behind our, like, in our corner. They were like, dude, this, like, little Canadian band just got signed to Vagrant and is doing all this cool stuff, and it was, like, kind of became, like, a, like, we got a gang, like, we got a team together. Like, it wasn't like, oh, like, people didn't turn on us. It wasn't that time yet. We were really lucky. Like, I know that happened to other bands where, a little bit of success starts happening and people turn on them. Like, we were pretty lucky there. People were, I think, were kind of like, whoa, like, the underdogs are, like, making it happen. Like, let's do this. We're all on a ride. Like, and, yeah, what a cool time. It really was.
And then you guys reissue the vinyl in 2012. And you add two tracks, and then there's two demos as well on an accompanying 7-inch. Were the two added tracks, His Own Anomaly and Prepare Yourself, were those recorded at the same session?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, those are two, especially that, what's the first one called?
His Own Anomaly. His Own Anomaly. Right. The numbers, the coordinates. Yeah.
Where do those lead? there's like a lot of weird secret stuff in Monin Records, but we recorded those at the same time, but it was definitely like, we knew we loved those songs, but I didn't think they fit on that record, especially His Own Anomaly. That's a pretty, like, that's, I went through a time of, like, pretty Muse obsessed.
Okay.
And, like, I discovered, like, early Muse records before they blew up over in the States in the UK. I went into a record store and I was like, hey, I'm into, like, aggressive music, but I like, you know, I like weird stuff. And I try to explain, I was like, I would really love for you to introduce me to a new band from the UK that I wouldn't know about back home. So this guy is like, oh, like, well, here, try this band. And he gave me two Muse records, which was Absolution and Origin of Symmetry. And it blew my mind, and I got so obsessed. And now, after saying that, if you listen to that His Own Anomaly, you can hear what I was listening to, because it's like there's a lot of musisms in there. But at the time, people didn't really know Muse. It was like, so I could get away with it. But it didn't belong on the record. But it was, like, definitely a really cool song.
Yeah, and then the two demos, were those the demos from the Gerg sessions?
You know what? I don't know, to be honest. Do you know what? Does it list what they are?
No, it's on a 7-inch. Hold on. Yeah. It might be on the actual 7-inch. Oh, shit. I put the 7-inch with my 7-inches.
On him. Yeah, you know what? I to be honest, I don't remember what those... I think they were not Gerg demos, because I remember them not sounding so good.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah. I don't think they came out that great on that 7-inch. So I think they were early demos that we recorded. His Own Anomaly, I wonder if that's the same exact song. See, I don't know, like, I still don't know names for songs very well, because they're
they're massive on this.
We would have jam titles, and that's how we would but that Prepare Your song was a really cool song. That was another one that I rewrote the lyrics and stuff to while we were recording, because something happened in my life, and not to me personally, but to a really close friend, and it changed what I wanted that song to be about, and I ended up writing it for a friend. And so that song in particular is a really special one to me. I love that song a lot, actually.
And that was because this, it originally came out kind of peak CD era. Like, there was only a couple. I still haven't been able to get an original pressing. I just have this Record Store Day one. Was that the idea behind the Record Store Day? Was because it was so tough to get that first?
Yeah, I think 300 of the original.
It's
pressing.
Like $250 to $300 on Discogs if you're trying to get
it. I heard that. Like, Justin was telling me that it's still, even with the other versions out, the original is. And that's a pretty cool thing, like, to have a record that is, because I'm a vinyl fan myself, so to have a record that is, like, kind of like a bit of a little cool piece is pretty cool. But, yeah, we decided to just do another version and keep the pressing going, because, like, I would, every time we play a show, like, I would have multiple kids asking, like, when are you going to do Red Tree vinyl? And I was just like, well, we should probably do it. But, like, honestly, when we did that vinyl, like, it was, like, early on before, like, it was, like, while vinyl was, like, kind of happening again, but it wasn't, like, Dynalone didn't have the hookups that they have now. I think we were the first vinyl release for Dynalone, actually.
Yeah, it was, like, that weird transition period where, like, CDs weren't fully done yet, but...
Yeah,
because I think that show at the Starlight, you played with Attack in Black, and they were playing off the Widows EP.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Wait a second, that's right. Like, you know what's funny, though? Someone just told me that Justin actually just told me that CDs are back up again.
Oh, really?
CD sales have gone up.
It's the only thing, like, you can get now. Pandemic. You can't get LPs, Bress. You're waiting
a
year plus
true.
Now at this point.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Tell Justin, because you guys did a DVD with the Red Tree here, but you can't get it because you can only get it with that pressing. And so I actually emailed Dynalone, but no one got back. I said, just put the digital in the store and let people rent it or buy it. I want to see this. It's like a making of. Do you remember doing that while you were
Yeah. Were there? Yeah, that probably won't ever be put up on a digital thing.
No?
No, that doesn't bring back the best memories for us.
Oh, really?
There's a lot of funny stuff on the DVD, and the movie is, like, got a lot of great footage, but it doesn't represent our true memories for that experience. It goes pretty dark sometimes.
Oh, interesting.
Gets a little too serious.
Oh, okay.
That's not really my style.
Yeah.
But there is some really funny stuff, and there is some like pretty cool extra content that we put on there too. But, like, the main thing that's built around this movie doesn't bring back the best memories for me. But the you know what else I just realized? Here's another funny thing, is Justin just reminded me that some of our early CDs were enhanced CDs. Like,
oh, yeah.
I somehow got into
them in
enhanced
the computer.
CDs.
Yeah.
You put them in the computer and you can open up, and I would have all this, like, bonus stuff and things, but people would never know because no one's going to think about putting in your CD in the computer to, like, open anything. You put it in there to rip it or whatever, right?
Well, like, even on this, you have the backwards playing intro. Like, there's a song before Lock on the CD, and then on this repress, you guys actually... It's actually pressed as the intro.
Oh, I forgot that, did we? Yeah. It's on there, eh?
I put the record on, and I was like, what is this?
Oh, wow, I forgot we did that. Yeah. You know what's funny about that is, so the morning I was flying to New York to sit in on the mastering session, and I remember that morning, and it hit me. I was like, because I always really wanted to, like, connect the records. So each record connects in some way. And so this one, I was like, I don't think we had the sequence exactly worked out, so I didn't know how to connect it. But then the cab was coming for me, actually, and I was like, crap. And I grabbed this little digital recorder and threw it down in the basement and sat at the top of my basement stairs and sang that part, if it's what I remember is on the vinyl. But what it is definitely what's on the CD in the negative track of the track one there. And I just sang that, I think it's part of, like, song I swore to, song I swore, no, this, whatever the long ending song on Really Happy is, which I have no idea what
yes.
that's called.
Oh, okay.
Last song I ever want to sing.
It's the last
like
song
that.
From the
This is
the
pathetic. I don't know any of our song
it,
titles,
yeah.
but yeah. So I basically just threw this recorder down and then, and played it real quick, and then the cab showed up, and I went to New York, and then we were mastering the record, and I was like, hey, I really want to do this thing, and I gave him this digital recorder, but it's funny, we're in this, like, crazy Sterling Sound mastering. It's like an insanely professional studio. And I throw him this little digital recorder. I was like, hey, can I get, I want to put this in the negative numbers of the first track. So it's kind of like a hidden thing. And it took him a while to figure out how to get it off this thing. Cause he's like, man, we don't really do, people usually just give us files and we work on it. Like, I don't know what to do here. So it became like a bit of a mission for him. But I didn't tell any of the guys about it. And the record came out, and then finally a kid at Warped Tour comes up to Eric. Hey, what's up with that negative track stuff? And Eric's like, what are you talking about? He's like, the negative track on Red Tree. And Eric's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So anyways, he went to the merch table and got a CD and then went to the bus and checked it out. And then he was like, oh my God, what is this? Every record I've put a little secret in there that the guys don't know about.
That's hilarious.
And then they end up finding out at some point.
So after this record, you have two years, I believe it's Peter leaves around 2008. Does he miss the recording of World I Want to Leave Behind?
Yeah.
Okay, so drummer Peter leaves, you bring in another guy. What were you
there's
feeling?
An EP that we did.
It was blue. The cover is blue.
No, that was a different one. That was the Hold the Sound.
Hold
EP,
Sound. Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, before that was a red one, and it was like a little companion to Red Tree. And we did these reimagined, like, acoustic and atmospheric versions of some of the songs. And it was at that time, actually, that no one knew, but Peter was out of the band at that point. We had parted ways pretty much. I don't know if it was fully official, but we went and did that recording with Gerg at his second home studio, where you guys would have recorded, I think. We went there and we did this whole EP, but any of the drums I just played, like Peter wasn't around at that point. And it's cool though. Like, honestly, it's like a little brother to Red Tree. Like this, like, some of the things we started doing live, like, you know, our guitar tech Harris started playing on some songs with us and started putting piano over stuff. So we actually added things to some of these Red Tree songs and made these different versions. And, but at that point we knew that, yeah, us and Peter, I think had parted ways. It was fine. There was no like bad feelings or anything. It just wasn't working. And then that's when we got our new drummer Steve and started working on that world record.
How is that recording experience different coming off what you had just experienced with the Red Tree?
It was completely different. It was really very very different. It was great. I also learned a lot of things from that one too. We did it with a guy named David Bottrell and Brian Moncars, and David Bottrell is actually. He's known for doing like Tool records, and he did a Silverchair record that I really really love a lot. He did some early Muse stuff, so he was like in a completely different world. But we were kind of in a completely different headspace when it came to those songs. Now that would be a whole different podcast talking about that record, because it wouldn't be as positive sounding. Not that we had a negative experience doing it, but it was just. If you listen to that record compared to any other Monin records, it's a weird one. Like, I think I was just personally getting into like a lot of different stuff, and it's not the most cohesive Monin record, I'd say, but it was an amazing experience, and it was very different because we're working with this guy that's like a world-class dude, and his brain is just a few steps ahead of anyone else, and you know, who's used to doing like punk rock recordings. But it was incredible. It was amazing. I think we put out a really awesome record with like a lot of great songs, but is it my favorite Monin record? No, I would definitely say not, but there's some pretty heavy riffs and I always wanted to write some pretty heavy riffs. So
it's funny. Cause I recorded with Gerg a little bit after that. I can't remember. It was either the session was done, but the record wasn't out, or the record had just come out. And it's when I saw a part of Gerg that I love so much, and why we keep going back to him on this recording, is he was like so protective of you guys and the band. Yeah. Like I don't trust this guy that's helping him. He's like, I know he's this big producer, but he's like, I feel like if we could have all just recorded it here and done it together, we could have made something truly amazing. And it was like, he was really passionate, really fired up.
Me and Gerg have had those conversations. And like, I think there was even a moment where I was even like, oh, should we just like, you know, go back with our pals and like do it how we know, like beforehand. But we like we were in a bit of a different headspace. Like we want to try something completely different. So, but I did, I took a lot away from that as well. And Brian Moncar is the engineer on that one. Cause that's a whole nother story. There's a whole lot of other things that, like Botro was doing an AFI record at the same time, which I think he was released from during our record. So he wasn't even there for a lot of our record at first. And then he came in with this kind of like wanting to like, you know, like wants redemption. He just got let go of this other record. So it was like a real weird time. But me and Brian Moncars became really, really great friends and did a lot of work together after that. But I think it was just, you know, because shortly after that record was released, I had my first son, and then my heart just wasn't into it anymore. And during a Europe tour, I decided that I think I was done. And I'm glad I wanted to quit the band and stop it and announce that the band is done, and because I like finality, and I am, like I've said many times in this podcast, I'm pretty stubborn. So I think if the guys had let me, like, really truly stop the band and not just quit the band, I don't think we would have got to do as many cool things as we've done since, because we left it at a let. You know what? Let's not stop the band. And I was like, okay, well, what if we announce like a hiatus? And they're like, no, we don't want to do that either. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of weird, because it's strange to not say anything. But that really did. That was weird for fans, I'm sure, but it also left the door open, and then we started to just get to do fun things that we wanted to do, and it's been a. We've done some of the coolest things we've done in a band have been since we technically kind of broke up.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I want to ask you one specifically, because it almost took me as a bit of a surprise. I'm wondering if it took you guys when you announced those Are We Happy shows in Toronto that you ended up just adding dates and adding dates because it was selling out so quickly. Did you guys anticipate that? Because I remember seeing it being like, oh, I got to grab tickets for that tomorrow, and attempting to and be like, oh, there's none for this huge room.
Yeah, you know
and
what?
Then
no,
there was
like
a second show, and it was gone. And then there was a third show, and it was gone.
See, we did a Red Tree, string of Red Tree shows, and then we did a string of really happy shows. So I remember when the Red Tree ones, like, yeah, I think we initially were like, okay, well, maybe we'll do two shows at Lee's Palace. And then, yeah, they sold it immediately. But the funny thing is I was sleeping, and I was on tour with another band, and I was sleeping in a hotel somewhere, and no one could get a hold of me, and they had to keep adding shows. So I finally woke up to, I think it was in the end, five shows.
Five, yeah.
And being like, what the frick has been going on while I was asleep? They're like, well, we couldn't get a hold of you, so they just kept adding shows, so we just kept saying yes, we don't know. And like, I remember, I think I woke up on the fifth one, and that's when I saw these messages, and they're like, should we add a sixth? And I was like, no, no, stop it, what is going on? So so that was like, that was pretty wild, and it was very cool to get to relive this record in that way. It was like super, super cool, and we got to ask some really, really special friends to come play with us. And like Matt Pryor from the Get Up Kids flew out and came and played with us. You know, we had Alexis play, Flatliners, like George's other band, Dead Tired. Like, it was amazing. We just had basically our friends, and then having Full Blast with us was just like, that was a magical, magical, magical time.
Yeah, it was the same thing as like the signing to Vagrant. It was like, I remember seeing that being like, you know, years later being like, yes, They another victory. Like, we got another one.
This
was our band. And
And then we got to do it again with that really happy record. And that again surprised us, because we went to a much bigger venue and ended up doing three shows there. But it was like, that's the thing. Like, I'm very stubborn. And I think if they had have agreed with me to stop the band, I think I would have stopped the band and never done it again.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is stupid. It's like the dumb way to live your life.
But now, if you had to choose your favorite child, where do you rank the Red Tree in your own discography?
That's tough. I used to always think it was like that was our record, but then I think I realized after how extra special Really Happy became to me.
Yeah, I thought those might be one too.
Yeah. So I wouldn't put anyone over, but if I had to, I'd probably say smaller chairs.
No, you know, there's some guy listening to this who's going to be like, yeah, I told you, that's my favorite one. Yeah,
it is.
This Red Tree shit sucks. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, great EP. Man, this was awesome to talk to you about all this. I've taken up way more of your time than I originally said.
Well, I hope you don't mind editing it up because I talked a lot.
No, it was great. Like we talked about, this was a huge record for me. You know, it came around when I was 15 years old, and still to this day love it. Still a huge influence.
Thank you.
I play with three delay pedals and a reverb now, and I think that's
mainly you guys.
Yeah, it's out of control for how poorly I play guitar, but
no, it makes your guitar playing better.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling.
I'm not a good guitar player, but I can just turn on a bunch of delay pedals and do some cool stuff.
Yeah, well, hopefully we find a way to see you guys again sometime soon, man.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'll tell you, like, nothing. There's some shows coming up, and the Monin gears are starting to go again. And
awesome.
I think there's going to be some pretty cool stuff coming.
Perfect. Thanks, Kenny.
All right, man. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for sticking around all the way through that. Thanks so much again to Kenny for spending so much time with me talking about that, talking about the record, talking about Loss, talking about the band in general. This was a big one. I love this album. I love this band. I think you really got a sense of who Kenny is through this interview. He is that guy, you know, on a show where there's 10 people in the crowd, and he's that guy, you know, playing five nights in a row, sold out shows in a huge venue. And I feel like these sorts of records make more sense when you get to know the people involved and how they made them and who they made them with and what these goals were. This episode really encapsulated everything I want to do with this podcast. I really want to pull the curtain back on what people think or imagine goes on in these sessions. It's not just, it's a ton of work. It truly is. And I think people view art as this intrinsic thing that comes naturally to this certain small group of people, and the recording is easy because this is just their natural gift talent. No, this is a group of people working incredibly hard to create art together. And shout out to Greg Dawson, who we talk about all throughout the episode. That's another key component of this. There's these people along the way with Monin that left these marks and left these imprints, and Greg is one of those guys. He made a huge impact on me, not just musically, but just as a person and how I want to live. And now with kids of my own, seeing how he raises his family, he's another incredibly important part of this story. And Kenny talks about him so glowingly. Those guys are great friends. And if you have one takeaway from this, it is everything this band does is just true to themselves and the people around them, and it yields these great results, and it builds these ties, and people see that and see how authentic it is, and they bind themselves to it like I did with this record. So thanks so much for sticking around and listening. We're gonna have some more episodes coming up. You need to get in contact with us the best way, the Instagram, That One Record Podcast. Search the handle. You need to email me, thatonerecordpodcast@gmail.com. Just share this around. Put it in your Instagram stories. You know, send it to someone who you know is a big Monin fan who maybe doesn't even know what a podcast is. Like, that's just the best way to get people into this kind of stuff. So thanks for sticking around. That was episode 10.